Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I'd like to welcome you here this evening. My name is Matthew Horton. I'm head of alumni relations here at the school. This is the eighth of our city alumni group tonight. The subject is corporate governance. Before we get on with the proceedings, I'd just like to remind you that outside the door there on the table, there are some leaflets and various memorabilia and bits and bobs about alumni relations. So please help yourself to those after the debate. After the debate, everybody is welcome to come and join us for a networking reception in the atrium, which is out of the doors and to the left. We're going to share a glass of wine and have an opportunity to chat about the subject that you hear tonight. The director will introduce Lord Burns, so I will hand over to Howard David Clark.
Well, señoras, señores, es un orgullo para mí presentarles esta noche al presidente de AB National, una sucursal del Banco Santander Centro Hispánico, quien tendrá la difícil tarea de trabajar y hablar en español a toda hora. Well, we're hoping to hear a little bit about what it's like to be a part of the Spanish Empire, now that Terry has taken his troops into foreign employ. But I think we'll probably also hear some reflections on his views of the city, regulation thereof, because Terry has had a unique set of perspectives as the Permanent Secretary to the Treasury, of course, responsible or increasingly responsible over the years for the government's relations with the city, which were, in an earlier time, rather uncomfortably shared with the DTI, but the Treasury, under Terry's imperial leadership, gradually took over more and more of these responsibilities. And then, of course, as the chairman of a joint committee that oversaw the creation of the Financial Services Authority, the Financial Services and Markets Act, then moving into the city, initially actually on the board of Legal and General, and then taking over as chairman of AB National, and then more recently an interesting experience of dealing with shareholders, large and small, as AB National decided that its future lay more satisfactorily within a larger European group than as an independent entity. The title, Corporate Governance and the City, can cover a multitude of sins and gives you a fairly free rein this evening, Terry. We thought you'd be an ideal person to talk to our alumni, who are typically people who are working in the city, but who have a clear interest in the sort of public policy dimension of financial services. And so we're very pleased you could spare an hour or two from your current task of taking apart the BBC as chairman of an independent panel advising the government on the future of BBC under its new charter. And we're pleased to have you here. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Well, thank you, Howard, for those kind words introduction. When I invited to speak to such a distinguished audience, I think there's only one thing worse than deciding whether or not one has the nerve to take it on, and that is having to decide a title well in advance of the occasion on which you're actually going to prepare your remarks. And so the way that I normally deal with this is to have a sufficiently broad title, as Howard says, that it can cover a multitude of sins. And so I came across this title, Corporate Governance in the City, but I do want to, in a sense, refer to it loosely and cover a number of issues. I want to say a little bit about my own experiences, both in terms of the Treasury, what we were doing in the Treasury, although relatively briefly, and then what it's like being on the other side of the fence. My challenge is to look at some of these issues, the role of the FSA, the government, the treatment that I've had from investors at various stages, as well as how I believe the present, in a sense, government arrangements are working as well. And I've got to try and do that without upsetting Howard in the process, which of course, it will be itself be a challenge. I've been chairman of the Abbey for, I think, almost exactly 3 years. When I started, the share price was £10. Within a relatively short period, it was down to almost £3, and then it's come back. Well, at the point at which we sold it, I think it was £6.45. There have been some very widespread changes in the senior management. I had several merger or acquisition approaches that came to nothing, and the one that Howard has referred to, of course, ending up with this rather large cross-European takeover, sale to Santander. In the meantime, I've been through the experience of being fined by the FSA for failures associated with anti-money laundering rules, and at times have felt to be in permanent session with them on other issues. I've had to run the gauntlet of major shareholders whose main concern at various stages was trying to require from me a pledge that the position of individuals would never stand in the way of selling the company, as they clearly thought this was what it was that they were hoping to achieve. And of course, I had the well-publicized abuse by a number of small shareholders at an EGM as we brought our proposal to sell Abbey to them for approval. I have, of course, had other experiences of governance and dealing with the city. I was one of a small group of people who set up Glass Cymru, a not-for-profit company, which then bought Welsh Water, entirely financed by debt. And so I've had the experience also of dealing with bondholders in large numbers. And that organization also follows the combined code, although it is, of course, regulated too by Ofwat. I also had the experience of being on the board of British Land when we had the approach from Laxey Partners and the whole issue of John Ritblatt combining the positions of chairman and chief executive, and that also involved quite a lot of rounds of the city. And indeed, there was one stage when I was dealing with both that and with an approach from yet another foreign bank, and was sort of doing my best to try and make sure that I could arrange the meetings on the same day so that I wasn't traveling, reduce the amount of traveling. So I've had quite a lot of exposure to some of these issues in a relatively short time. But as Howard's referred to, I would like to say something about the development of the regulatory regime from my perspective. It feels not so much as if it is gamekeeper turned poacher, I have to say, sometimes as gamekeeper turned hunted species, another subject that I actually spent a little bit of time on at one stage. I will also say something about, in a sense, what the role of markets, of course, in all of this, which I think has got a lot to do with some of the problems that we have had. During the time I was chief economic advisor, I had relatively little to do with financial regulation. It was basically a macro job, but it was when I became permanent secretary in 1991 that financial regulation became a much bigger part of my responsibilities. I'd been in the job a matter of weeks when Eddie George called to tell me that the bank was about to close BCCI, and it was brought me somewhat up short at that stage. I was then faced with setting up an inquiry, hiring Lord Justice Bingham, who delivered his verdict on the conduct of bank and treasury officials in a timely manner, and I think that was 10 years ago, and the dispute is still in the courts at the moment. It took me some time, I have to say, to understand the principles behind financial regulation, or certainly the logic of the roles that we had at that stage, where we had not only a mass of different bodies doing the regulation, but they all seemed to report to different government departments. And one of the tasks I had when I took over was to chair a quarterly meeting of the various regulatory bodies and departments that were responsible for them, and they more or less filled what I have to tell you was a rather large office that I had in the Treasury. It was readily evident that there was a problem with the separation of responsibilities for different parts of the financial services industry, and that many of the banks were, of course, engaged with both banking and financial services more generally. We managed to persuade the Prime Minister and Chancellor to transfer the responsibility for the Securities and Investment Board to the Treasury after the 92 election, but that was about as far as we went. We then had the collapse of Barings, and shortly after that, quite unrelated, I have to say, we had a vacancy of a deputy governor because of Rupert Pennant Ray's resignation, and I managed to persuade Howard to leave the CBI to take on the job, and we then went through another stage in this sort of crisscross of relationships that I have had with them over the years. After the 97 election, we succeeded in getting responsibility for insurance transferred from the DTI to HMT, although I'm not sure that any of my former colleagues would actually forgive me for that, given what subsequently happened in some of those areas. But more importantly, of course, we had the setting up of the single regulator for financial services in the shape of the FSA. And once again, it was my task to call upon Howard and try to take him, to persuade him to take on this even greater responsibility, which he, of course, did with the, you know, without a moment's hesitation, I think. By the time I left the Treasury in the summer of 98 and moved along the street to the House of Lords, we had a draft bill, we had a period of consultation, and lo and behold, as he said, I found myself as chairman of the joint committee charged with undertaking this pre-legislative scrutiny of the bill. And two of the big issues, of course, were enforcement processes and the new offence of market abuse. One of the proposals that came out of that joint committee was that in the future the role of the executive chairman should be split between a part-time chairman and a chief executive on the basis, really, that nobody apart from Howard would be capable of doing both of these jobs at the same time. He never liked it, and I have to tell you that he complains to me about it on every possible occasion. However, more or less, of course, since the Act came to force, we've had nothing but bad news in the financial services industry. Things like the Equitable problem, the issue of endowment mortgages, zero bonus declarations in the life industry, pension fund shortfalls, precipice bonds, regulatory breaches of anti-money laundering rules, and we could go on, of course. I think what is important is to recognize, of course, that in no sense am I blaming all of this on the legislation and the FSA. I think it is one of those unfortunate coincidences. And part of my thesis, and it's affected very much some of the things which I inherited at Abbey, has been that the heart of the problem has been the boom bust in equity prices combined with low interest rates and low inflation, which affected some of the problems. I have no intention of trying to explain why this happened or why UK equity prices have performed so much worse than in many other countries, but the results have been quite stark. For many borrowers, endowments are projected to be insufficient to pay off mortgages. The product, I think, turned out to be ill-suited to a period of sharply falling interest rates combined with the failure of equity prices to recover. We had problems with the life industry, with smoothing and guarantees, etc., and of course Equitable failed to the whole problem of failing to deal with falling interest rates and guarantees that came to be in the money. We had precipice bonds, which were designed to try to give some protection against changes in equity prices, but of course were then severely hit by the extent of the fall in equity prices. During the bull market, companies had pension holidays, partly because of the requirements of the legislation, and then of course when the reversal took place, they had the big problem of making up those deficits. And I think what is the impact of all of this on the equity market has really been very substantial. We can see very clearly the declining interest in the retail market for equity products and the move towards bond products and structured products with some kind of guaranteed capital repayment. With profits, funds have been forced to reduce their equity ratios to reduce the extent of the risk in portfolios, and very similar things have been happening with pension funds. And these things, of course, have fed upon them themselves in terms of the behavior of markets. And I think this has itself had enormous impact upon a lot of the problems for those companies, you know, like banks and other financial services companies who have been selling these products, who sold them some time ago, and of course have been having a great deal of difficulty with customers since. And it was really into this kind of background that I ventured when I took on this job of being chairman of Abbey. The timing was almost perfect, not because of what was happening to financial markets, but it actually coincided with the new system of approved persons coming into play, and I think I was almost the first person through that process. And from then on, I've been on basically the receiving end of the FSA's processes. And the events, of course, that then subsequently happened, I think, can be stated quite briefly. Before being appointed, between being appointed and actually taking on the job, we had the collapse of Enron, and it turned out that Abbey National had a substantial position in Enron. We had a £60 billion wholesale banking position, which was not a pretty sight when marked to market following some of those market movements. We had two life companies with high equity backing ratios. They'd sold considerable business during the late 90s with guarantees. And the end result of this, of course, was a profit warning in the summer of 2002. The chief executive left, and I had the task of being the executive chairman for 3 months before recruiting a new chief executive, during which time we had at least two approaches from other banks. The stock market then continued to fall, of course, until the spring of 2003. And just about by the time we had then managed the unwinding of the wholesale bank position and reached agreements with the FSA about our with profits funds, and things just began to stabilize, we were then subject to the bid from Banco Santander, and that is what has been occupying us, of course, for the last 6 months. In, I think, looking at some of the issues about governance and regulation, I have reflected quite a lot on, in a sense, the role and some of the behavior of the financial service companies themselves. I think the main characteristic, of course, of financial services and this companies, and there's nothing originalist at all, of course, is the extent to which we have the uncertainty of the outcome of many of the products that they sell. And of course, we have the big impact that this has on people on how to protect their savings, how quickly they pay off a loan, how much they're going to save to provide for a particular level of pension. And the risks that are inherent in almost everything one has to do with financial services. But it's actually very difficult for much of the time for customers and indeed for some of the companies to deal with. We know that it's sensible to diversify risk, and the management of risk requires an explicit understanding of people's risk appetites, about how much they're prepared to lose, which then in turn varies with circumstances, it varies with age, with certainty of income, and a whole series of things. And of course, unfortunately, we only know after the event just how much risk people have actually taken. In general, we try to assess risk by reference to the past, but inevitably it's the tails of the distribution and the extreme events which catch us out. And this problem, I think, of financial service businesses taking place in this atmosphere of really great uncertainty and the unpredictability of markets, volatility of asset prices, the increasing uncertainty of things like how long people are going to live, changing family structure and working patterns, and of course the whole issue about long-term commitments that, in terms of work, etc., have added to much of this. And so you start off with a relatively uncertain background, although one that at the time is not always seen at how uncertain it is. And then I think one is fair to say have a situation where the financial services industry has not always helped itself against this background. I mean, my observations coming to it in the last few years is and this is one of the striking features, is the extent to which financial services as a group have really behaved as manufacturers rather than retailers producing what you might think that customers wanted, but very much looking at it from a product end in terms of producing those things that they think they can produce and upon which they can make decent margins. Very often they've created confusing, I think, and inconsistent product ranges. Employees actually very often have considerable difficulty explaining the products to customers, and the focus is very much on the product, and because it is so complicated, very often rather less on the needs of customers. And I think this has been a pattern for quite some time. And you see some of the complications in all sorts of products. Mortgages are sold with short-term discounts. It gives the impression of penalizing loyal customers. It results in increasing amounts of churning. Customers lose their loyalty to individual companies and basically find that the real benefit is in shopping around. And of course, the whole financial services industry has been through an enormous process trying to compete by cutting costs. You see banks closing branches, ending of direct sales force. We see the encouragement of customers to try to use less expensive channels like telephones and the internet, and an enormous use of automatic systems. And of course, it has been in many ways very successful. It's enabled the industry to industrialize several of the products that they have had, bring them to a mass market, and have enabled people to to buy them, where very often they would have been limited to limited groups in the past. But of course, it is not an easy environment that against which you can give advice to people about complicated situations. And I say the tendency throughout has been, I think, to aim at the product side rather than at the customer's need side. There's been very heavy use, of course, of commissions in selling many of the long-term savings products, and the standards that have been set for that selling process have changed quite a lot over the period. And so we can see that the focus on meeting the needs of customers rather than selling products is expensive, and at times it has not been done. And I think the combination of the volatile markets and the scrutiny of the FSA has forced companies to re-examine a great deal of how they handle this. And it also lies behind quite a lot of the tensions that have existed in recent times with the FSA, and of course quite a lot of the complaints and the difficult relations with the press about a lot of these things. I think there is growing acceptance that there is an important role to be played by advice from financial providers. There is also growing acceptance, I think, that it is necessary to re-examine the remuneration structure of advisors to seek to try to eliminate bias in products that are sold. And these are many of the issues that the companies have been trying to deal with, and which I have been very much observed in recent times. It's this kind of background, and I've labored to some degree, because I think in order to understand both the FSA's role in this, our response to the FSA, and then some of the issues that go on to corporate governance, it is quite important to understand the background against which some of the financial service companies have been operating, and why it is that there has been quite a lot of tension in this. When you come back and you look at the behavior and how things have worked out with the FSA, I have to say that from my own perspective, I am broadly content with the development of the way that it's worked and the Financial Services Act, although, you know, everyone, I think, is worrying about the amount of management time that is involved in compliance. I think when you come to look at the balance sheet of this, I think one has to say that it has been, up to this point, relatively a success. I mean, I start by being relatively inclined to agree that, you know, that financial regulation is necessary. I have to say, when I was doing the joint committee, there were quite a lot of people who came to give evidence who sought to argue that selling financial services was really no different to selling washing machines, and why shouldn't they be simply subject to the Sale of Goods Act? I've never taken this position. I was convinced a long time ago that the characteristics of the products, about the risks that I've been talking about, the time scale over which people buy these products, the extent to which you want the companies to be in existence when people come to receive come to the end of the contract, the difficult judgment about what is suitable for the customer, are all issues which make this industry very different and I think very difficult. The broad conclusions I would reach would be to say that the move towards a single regulator with a broad mandate and authority to be able to deal with the ever more seamless and complex world of financial services has been a considerable success, and we can now see this being copied in other countries, of course. I think the extent which has been possible to do this and indeed unseparated from the activities at the Bank of England has been something that has worked very well. I think it has been very helpful to have a clear remit. We've had more clarity, I think, about the distinction, too, between prudential supervision and the conduct of business regulation. I think the FSA has been successful in making companies aware of the need for better standards across the industry. And I would also judge that it's had kept a reasonable balance between the concerns of consumers and producers to the extent that it's probably equally criticized by both sides. That alone is not sufficient evidence that you have got it right, but I think the balance of that from my perspective at this stage remains okay. I'd say that from the people that I work with, and indeed my own observations, there are some concerns about some matters, but in a sense they don't change that overall conclusion. The Financial Ombudsman Service, of course, has had to deal with a vast increase in customer complaints because of many of the factors that I was discussing earlier about the collapse of equity markets and the shortfalls in a wide range of investment schemes. The worries that we have is that out of this there is a danger that the Ombudsman becomes involved in taking some quite major decisions of principle which almost create new policy in itself. And of course there is always the argument you have about whether or not they're seeking to apply retrospectively to products that were sold 10 or 20 years ago the standards that you would like to apply to today. And I think there is quite a lot of nervousness amongst the people in the industry side about the way that that balance is working. And I think it is something that we have to take quite a lot of care about. The enforcement process is, as I said, I've had some first-hand experience of now. It was an issue that the Joint Committee were very much involved with. It is inevitable, and I think one has to face this, that there is a degree of bullying and plea bargaining that goes on when firms are pressured into settling with the FSA. You know, they're offered a slightly easier life and a lower fine, and even though they may have some doubts about their guilt, they would like to fight some of the cases they get on and they do settle. And I think, by and large, that works and has worked reasonably well, although having seen it at fairly close quarters, I have to say, you know, there is a danger involved in all of this, and that it can't go too far, otherwise the process does lose some degree of objectivity, and you will end up with many more cases with the tribunal. And so keeping the balance whereby you're going to get things settled reasonably quickly and not having them drawn out over a long process has got to be balanced against not wanting to have a situation where people feel that they have been adversely treated. I think there is also a feeling of people that I work with that there isn't sufficient difference of treatment of companies who find their own problems within their own organizations. They own up to them and they get on and they fix the problem by comparison with those situations where the identification of the problem has come from outside. And this doesn't seem to be very good for incentives. And how it is that, you know, obviously, if people have made bad mistakes, that has to be taken into account. But at the moment, there is a problem, as I see it, with incentives here. And then the third worry that I would say is most prevalent in organizations like Abbey is about the agenda for treating customers fairly, which is become a very big issue in with the FSA and amongst the financial services companies. I think it has been important to remind firms about the problems of recent years, but I think that it also has to be combined, and when one sets these standards for how one sells, the whole question of commission rates, the method of selling, the way in which products are described to people, there are some very important lessons to come out of it. But I think it also has to accept the extent of the risk that's inherent in many of these products, and that customers themselves have a duty of care, and that it shouldn't lead to a situation where it becomes impossible to actually sell products that are not capital guaranteed. And I think there is some danger of a bias emerging towards an assumption of mis-selling over mis-buying. You know, there are quite a lot of people now from whom I receive letters of complaint who really believe that, you know, if they made a choice between two products and they actually chose the least profitable one, that they have got some, you know, obvious case for redress as a result of this. And that culture is one that I'm afraid the financial services industry, and I've explained partly because of their own mistakes in the past, are going to find increasingly difficult. In looking at some of the other plays in this, government and parliament, of course, have had a very important part to play in it, and I think they, of course, should receive quite a good deal of the credit for setting up the regulatory system in the first place, which was pretty daring, and I must say was, at the time, I thought premature, but I think there's no doubt at all has been a success. I think the second thing government deserves credit for is for persisting with its policy of open markets in London, where we do not seek to protect UK firms, as we've just seen very starkly in the case of Abbey. And I think the result has been hugely successful as far as the city is concerned, and the fact that we could conduct our transaction with Santander without having to be concerned in any major way with whether or not the government would approve of this is, I believe, in the long run, a very good thing. And so I think that whole positioning of the government with regard to the financial services industry has contributed hugely to the success in London. But there are, I don't think the record's entirely spotless. I mean, there are people who think that the 1997 changes to corporation tax may have contributed to the weakness of equity prices, which, as I was trying to argue earlier, has had a good deal to do with many of the problems that the industry has faced. We're also seeing the whole issue of the approach to pensions proving to be very challenging, where government has got to meet the demands of an aging population without incurring an unacceptable level of budget restraint. But we've now ended up with a complex, means-tested approach, which can result for some people in very high effective tax rates, and it's going to make, again, the savings industry even more complex. The threat of terrorism and the money laundering rules, I have to say, has caused us a huge amount of problems. The whole system of reporting suspicious transactions, making account opening enormously difficult, has certainly caused us a lot of problems. Whether it's actually done much to stop money laundering, I think only time will tell. And I think the other thing I sort of worry about government is the extent to which they have continue to set up their own inquiries into the part of the financial system. I mean, it strikes me as very odd that you set up the FSA, then see, it's actually doing reasonably well, but you then set off having a whole series of other investigations from which you then cherry-pick recommendations, and I don't quite understand why this is going on. We're also seeing some tentative moves out of government to regulate products, which I think would be itself, it seems on the one hand, a relatively simple and straightforward way to offer people some simple products which can be sold under a light touch approach. But actually, I think there will continue to be some pretty difficult challenges in selling some of these. So the government side, I think, has, in terms of this, and again, the experience of being on the other side of this this fence, I think does reserve quite a lot of the credit for it, but there are some difficult signs that are also that are emerging. The investors is the next category of people that I'd like to comment on and explain and talk about some of my experiences. They, of course, are the owners, and in one sense, they are beyond reproach, as we are their servants. I would say that on balance, and they have, in terms of my own experiences with them, they have generally behaved pretty well. I mean, not all company chairmen would say that, but I think by and large they behaved as well as one might have hoped. After the profits warning, which I'd mentioned earlier, and the whole question of the chief executive of Abbey leaving, I was summoned to go around and see most of the major shareholders. Most of those discussions were conducted in a sensible way. They were happy to leave the timing to me, although they were pretty clear about the general path they wanted to see us follow. Some people, there were exceptions, or some people who were extraordinarily rude, but in general, that whole process and that kind of consultation worked reasonably well, and I think people showed a sensible balance in terms of patience and insistence. They showed a continuing interest in governance and the processes by which big decisions are reached. They were very anxious to know about any approaches that we have received in terms of takeover for the company. The other area where I've had a lot of discussions, of course, have been over remuneration discussions. And again, I don't have a lot of complaint. I mean, some of the institutions have got this obsession about TSR tests in terms of performance measurement, which I have to say has, as far as I can see, very substantial elements of being a random process other than when there is a takeover with a large premium. But in general, I think the method of consultation that we have followed with them and the way they've handled our remuneration committee has worked pretty well. And the bond investors I've dealt with Welsh Water have in themselves shown a very high degree of interest and understanding and involvement in the business, although it was pointed out to me at an early stage that dealing with bond investors is rather different, as they only have two requirements. One is that you pay the interest on time, and the other is that you repay the capital on time. And if you do that, by and large, your life will be reasonably straightforward. There are, however, a lot of people, I say, who have been through the process I've been through, and indeed some of my own observations that there are still some improvements that are necessary in these relationships. A lot of the combined codes set up arrangements whereby we're supposed to be consulting investors, and yet it's been painfully obvious to me that really the only time that investors want to see the chairman of a company is either when they want to change the CEO, when they want to influence the remuneration packages, or when they want to know why a potential takeover has been turned down. The rest of the time, they concentrate on the finance director and the chief executive to see if they can tell whether or not they're looking happy or not so happy, and what it is that they should be doing in terms of their projections. And it doesn't help, really, in terms of building an ongoing relationship. I was also really quite struck by this pattern, which I hadn't quite expected, in terms of the continuing insistence in wanting to know if there's been any hint of an interest in a transaction, and bordering on the hostile in tone if they thought there was any suggestion might be resisting it, deep suspicion that there might be approaches out there and that you were going to reject them because you worried about people hanging on to their jobs. And I have to say, it did create a general atmosphere during the transitional phase when we were trying to turn around this business, which made it quite difficult to get the period of time that you wanted in order to make that turnover. And I think it's quite interesting to see the way our share register emerged by the end of this. By the time we had the approach from Santander, we had a very big dominance and an unbalanced share register dominated by US value funds rather than by the UK institutions. And of course, it is those funds who then subsequently, of course, did best out of it. I also had some difficult meetings, as I mentioned, in the context of the Alaxi approach for British Land and the whole question of John Ritblatt being an executive chairman. I went on a round again of investors, and we spent quite a lot of time with them explaining in some detail the plans we had and the possible timing for splitting the jobs. And it was very interesting that for quite a lot of the investors, they were completely incapable of showing any flexibility on the issue. They said they had been mandated by several of the funds that they were investing, and if the job wasn't split, they just naturally had to vote against it. And I have to say, it didn't give me a huge amount of confidence in the approach of comply or explain, and that there really wasn't very much interest in the explaining side. And then, of course, as Howard mentions, is the issue about the small investors and my experience at the Wembley Conference Centre for our EGM on the Santander result. A very painful experience with 10 or 15 people or so managing to keep 1,000 people there for 4 hours by various procedural devices. The only consolation I had was that somebody said to me that the only thing that was important when you appeared at Wembley was the result. And it was a small consolation, but only that. So what's this all taught me about governance? I would my general conclusion, and again, this may seem a rather a soft one again, and maybe there's just not enough rebellion in me. I think the approach that has been followed on corporate governance in the UK, from the observation I've had over the last 6 or 7 years, I think works reasonably well. It is quite resource intensive. It leads to a lot of consideration about processes and potential conflicts of interest and lines of responsibility. I am not sure of any research. I'm sure there must be some, but I haven't seen any research that shows that good corporate governance produces better results as far as spectacular returns are concerned, or that the fact that poor corporate governance makes it that much more likely that you will see a company severely underperform. But I'm not sure that I would expect to be able to see that so clearly. And I don't even think that you need that evidence in order to justify the approach that we have, as long as people don't expect to see an end to disasters. I mean, I think that if we went through another process whereby there were failures and people said, well, there must be another huge corporate governance, it would worry me somewhat. But I think the general mechanisms that have been put in place, by and large, although quite expensive in terms of time, work reasonably well. I think boards are pretty well run. I think the structure of the single board of executives and non-executives works well. If you get the right, if it is working well, you get a good balance between challenge and letting the executives get on to manage the business. And I have to say, from my memories, I think the standards of corporate governance compare pretty well by the standards of governance in government, where I think there's a lot of scope for improvement in terms of lines of responsibility, accountability, definition of roles, and recording decisions and processes, as Lord Hutton pointed out, I think, very graphically. I think as a non-exec, there are some downsides of it, mind. I think as a non-executive on an audit committee is probably one of the scariest things that you can do these days. A huge amount is expected of audit committee, and Sarbanes-Oxley raises the stakes even further. I'm worried most about, you know, how on earth do you know if there's something that is going wrong? And the only protection I could see to myself was that you were relying rather heavily upon the external audit. I believe that the essence of the audit committee process would force issues to be disclosed more promptly than might otherwise be the case. And as we've seen in the US, if you don't get protection from the auditors, then aggressive executives can actually leave non-executives in a rather difficult position. And I think that most people I'd be surprised if most people who don't go through this process of being on an audit committee, let alone chairing it, as I have now chaired two audit committees, would find it really quite horrifying experience. Being a member of the Remuneration Committee is a bit better, but it's not that much better. You find that there's a whole plethora of schemes of long-term incentives and ongoing debate about the West way of constructing these performance tests. The first thing you have to do is to actually find out what all of the language means and what all these different schemes are and the way they apply in different companies and how the shorthand that is used about it. You know, the fact that the world springs surprises and that schemes are rarely straightforward is, I think, one of the biggest sources of difficulty. It actually turns out, and I've been through this process, it's surprisingly difficult to devise incentive schemes that both align the interests of shareholders and executives, which avoid too much discretion being left in the hands of the remuneration committee, and yet provide incentives at every stage of the business and the share price cycle. And I've been through a lot, and I've looked at a lot of these things now, and most of them fail in one way or another. You're either left with having too much discretion at the end of the day, the circumstances have changed, which means that the original tests no longer apply, and this all becomes quite an important source of tension with the or potential tension between the Remuneration Committee and the executives. I also think we've gotten a bit of a muddle in governance terms with the excluding the chairman of the company from the membership of remuneration committees. And what you often find with the remuneration committees is that proposals come forward, but it's actually not quite clear who's making the proposals, you know, whether it's the head of HR, the chairman of the remuneration committee, or the executives themselves through some indirect process. So there is a problem there. On the other hand, I have to say that there is another rule which is very widespread and seen as important, which is that the chairman should not be part of long-term incentive schemes. And I have to say, having been through this process of this takeover with Abbey, I can see the full force of that. It doesn't matter how carefully the rules are drafted, for the reasons I've just mentioned, there are, in almost all of these schemes, some point at which discretion has got to be exercised. And I have to say, I would not have liked to have been in the position where I was standing to benefit from that at the same time as having to apply some of the judgments that had to be applied. And, you know, I was always slightly doubtful as to why this was regarded as one of those tablets of stone. But having been through that experience, I think it is very clear and a very wise position. I think the issue of independence of non-executives is becoming quite complex. Now, I can see that limiting the length of service can be a very good thing in terms of turnover, provides the chairman with very good reasons for asking people to stand down when you might otherwise find that a difficult process. But I have to say, from my observation, there is no correlation at all between the length of time that people have served on a board and the extent of their independence from management. And indeed, there are periods when there may be inverse correlations. Some of the tests also are too stringent. A few years ago, I found myself again in the position where three of the non-executives at British Land were suddenly defined as not being independent in a rather helpful way. And there was even a moment when it was suggested I might not be independent because Abbey was occupying a British Land building, even though the decision had actually been taken some years before I joined to move into this particular building. And I do worry that we are moving towards a position where the only people qualified to become non-executive directors are going to have precious little to add to the process. But the tests that are being applied are just in some danger, I think, of going too far. I support the argument about CEOs not becoming chairman of the same company, but I think in recent months that has become more evidenced through a few cases of experience, although I'm less sure about the issue of not having of people not being allowed to be chairman of two companies, and that isn't a job I'm at, but it is my observation of people who are relative to those who are the chairman of, say, one company and who have a whole series of other responsibilities. And the final point I'd make on some of these governance things is that there's a big issue at the moment about board assessment, which I think is going to lead to a huge amount of fun. It was one of the suggestions from the Higgs Committee. The Legal and General Board, which I served on, had a very good system of assessing the board, and long before it was fashionable, and it was handled very carefully. And I do have some concerns that it won't always be done so. And what really upsets me is that every day in the post I get handful of letters and proposals from consultants of all sorts who wish to be part of this process of showing us how it is that we can assess the board. And I shudder at how some of this might work. I then see the same consultants actually producing research to demonstrate that not enough boards are engaged with assessment in sufficient detail. And I just begin to wonder about their conflicts of interest in this. Maybe it is the only successful part of the consultancy industry at the moment. So to summarise, I think that the thing that is I find most striking about all this, of course, is the extent to which it is not, when you're in the financial services industry, it simply is not possible to remove risk. There is no such thing as a zero-risk approach to investments and pensions. I think many people have got a distorted view of the ability of the market and institutions to deliver returns. You can only, I fear, make progress by helping people to manage the risks they're likely to face. That is an expensive process if you're going to do this. The firms are going to have a clear position of giving good advice, trying to sell products that customers understand and which suit their risk appetite. It is going to take quite a lot of time and quite a lot of resources. It will be that much more difficult to sell those products. I think the government, as I've mentioned, should learn to congratulate itself about what it's done so far. Maybe, as I said, the ombudsman scheme needs looking at, but I think in general government should step back from this area. I've also made one or two points about the FSA and the way that it handles enforcement, although I suspect that we're about to be subject to quite a number of documents reviewing the FSA's performance over its lifetime so far. And I hope that the industry, and I have one hope. I mean, it's become very fashionable to complain about compliance costs and about all of the difficulties that there are, but I think the industry does need to recognize to a significant degree that it itself has been part of this problem, and part of the costs associated with it are going to carry on until then some of these issues have been sorted out. I've mentioned the point about shareholders who seem to be obsessed by some of these short-term performance things, particularly in the desire to sell companies as soon as they're beginning to recover from some of their problems. And I do wonder how it is that some of the United States funds are able to take a longer view than some of ours. And finally, on governance, the point that I've tried to make is that companies are going to fail for all sorts of reasons, including poor strategy, poor judgment, poor risk control, etc. It is not necessarily the case that corporate governance is the reason for that failure. And I think the fashion that says that successes are down to corporate governance, that failures must inevitably be down to corporate governance, and therefore when we get the next high-profile failure, which is bound to happen at some point, that we're going to end up with the whole system of governance being overhauled again. So I've got not, my conclusions are, as I've tried to be balanced about them, there are none of these areas where I think there are serious problems. There are a number of places where there have been difficulties in the past, particularly in the industry. There's a lot of attempts being made now to get that sorted out. I think the FSA have played an important part in it, and I think the government is to be congratulated for having achieved that. And I think also there are some very good signs that the system of corporate governance that we now have is settling down reasonably well, and I can only hope to say that we don't have any high-profile collapses which make us decide to dig it all up again. Thank you very much, Howard.
Thank you. So that last point about reviews every time there's a collapse and overhauls was the one that, when I was chairman of the FSA, used to worry me the most, because if you look around the world at financial failures and the reviews that governments do, I mean, increasingly you can see that the first time they have a failure, a government sort of said, well, we can't really have this self-regulation anymore. We've got to go to statutory regulation. And then they say, well, we've got too many statutory regulators. We'd better merge a few. And then when you get to the end point of having one single regulator of everything, then what do you do? Because there's no... I mean, maybe it'll go to reverse and people start to divide them all up again. But, I mean, it did seem that you were kind of stuck. So the usual politician's response is to engage in some structural or organisational change in response to a problem. It's no longer...
Well, most of our legislation, I think if you do the same test here, you'd see that most of our legislation has actually followed failures of one kind or another. If you look at the banking, you know, when there were the Banking Acts and then the FSA, you know, the original, the 1976 one and subsequent.
This is what I call the dangerous dogs theory.
Yes.
Regulatory development, which is... now, I open it out to the audience and... as you ask a question, perhaps you could say whether you bought Abbey National shares at 10 and sold at 3, or whether you bought them at 3 and sold at 6, which may affect your nature of your question to Lord Burns. Yes, over here. There's a microphone just behind you.
Richard Simmons. My late father bought Abbey National at £1, and I sold them from the estate at £11. So I was very lucky.
That was just well, this had better be a polite question.
That must have been just before I became chairman.
Yes.
It certainly was. You started to respond to the concern that I had as you were speaking in the last few remarks you made, because the impression I got as you spoke was that you were broadly happy with the way things were developing, had developed in regulation, the FSA. You were... broadly happy with the framework of corporate governance that we have. But the thing that always concerns me, and my involvement in the sector is a long way back, because I was involved in setting up the International Accounting Standards Committee in 1973, and which is now the ISB, is that when I sort of hear the arguments today about, you know, current issues, they are remarkably familiar with those that were paraded 10 years ago, 20 years ago, and 30 years ago. And I just sort of, the thing that concerns me is doesn't seem to be any evidence that this much more sophisticated and elaborate frameworks of regulation and corporate governance will actually make any difference when we come to the next period of exuberance, which will come, and the corporate failures, which will follow, the next set of enthusiasms about financial services products, which will emerge when confidence comes back into the industry. I'm not sure what we do about it, but I do feel that we should perhaps challenge more critically some of the things that are introduced, and because the one that you mentioned that irritates most of us is the business of now having to show your passport to everybody on earth. And I mean, this came into sharp relief for me in the summer when there were 8 people in parallel wanting to look at my passport. And around that time I had dinner with Sir John Stevens, who said that the best quality passports were in fact available from the Finsbury Park Mosque.
Well, I personally, I think it's unfair to say that nothing has changed. I think what is, though, important is that I think these changes in corporate governance, the changes in regulation, can only move you up gradually over a period of time. What they can't do is deal very effectively with the tails, what I call, you know, think of as the tails of the probability distributions. When you get into these areas, it is very difficult for anything to protect you from some of them. But I don't think that should stop you trying to improve matters over time. And I think that's That is what I think we have seen. And but there is a huge danger that because one of these events takes place, you then have everybody wanting to change things all over again. As you know, I've seen no. I mean, maybe here we are. Maybe Alessina. I've seen no evidence actually that you can relate very closely, you know, corporate governance to successes of, you know, success or failures of companies to the standards of their corporate governance. But I don't think that's, you know, I think there are still a great deal, not a lot of benefits that come out of doing it well.
There's another one just near the back, and then answer.
Ian Johnson. Richard, who I have known briefly over the last 40 years, I'd like to ask two questions, which is a bit naughty. One is, you only mentioned the Higgs report once in your time, and you only mentioned Sarbanes-Oxley once, both of which I think are having a huge impact on what is happening to UK corporations, which are international, and US corporations, which operate in the UK. And I say that having signed off 3 Sarbanes-Oxley certificates. And I would like to ask, what is your opinion upon the impact of both at the moment? And the second one is, you've moved from a non-commercial to a commercial environment, and I'd like to ask how you feel you've been qualified to do that, and what's been your impression of how difficult it's been to do. Thank you.
When you say moving, he's moved away from a non-commercial environment to commercial. He's still at Abbey National.
My view is that the Higgs and Sarbanes-Oxley are quite different in this regard. I wouldn't say that apart from, you know, I mentioned there's an issue of board assessment, there are some, you know, there's this issue about not having, you know, chairman have two jobs. There is a bet, you know, there is an insistence on doing a number of things in terms of setting up what people's responsibilities are. You know, and I've been through this now in at least 4 companies. I don't think that they have been enormously intrusive, because most of those things were being done by a lot of companies anyway. Sarbanes-Oxley is a different matter altogether, where I'm involved in that on two places, and it has involved a huge disruption to the operation of the company. Now, the issue and what is said in response is that this is a one-off process, that if you can get it sorted out the first year and you get a sign-off to a lot of these processes, then life will be, you know, will settle down again afterwards. And I've even heard some Americans argue that companies are enormously grateful for having been put through this process in order to check that they are doing things well. So, I found the Sarbanes-Oxley thing. I'm much more worried about than I am about Higgs. I would say Higgs has not, been a huge. Certainly in my life, it hasn't been a huge, made a huge impact. Qualified. Taking up Howard's point, as I mentioned in my remarks, I set about. I had this experience 3 or 4 years ago, setting up this not-for-profit company, which then bought Welsh Water, and then I became chairman of Abbey. And one of my colleagues, who was on the Welsh Water board, who happened to be a director of another bank, he said that I'd obviously taken it as upon me in life to be chairman of nothing but not-for-profit businesses, whether it was intentional or it was by accident. What do I feel? I have found, I haven't found the change into non-executive roles hugely different. I mean, there are many of the same things that are involved, you know, where you're reviewing, you're advising, you are testing, you're challenging things, where, you know, getting to know the subject and understanding the marketplace, understanding the people. You know, they involve skills and approaches to life which are you know, don't vary that much, I find, in different activities. I found being involved with politicians and senior civil service, you know, pretty adequate training for some of these tasks. I think it would be completely different actually, the notion of being... The period that I was executive chairman, which I had to be for 3 months, now that was a pretty scary thing because I did not feel awfully well prepared for that. And I think it's a very big difference between coming out of the background I came out of to do a chief executive job than it is to do the sort of non-executive chairman type of job, which I think is actually quite a reasonable match of skill sets.
One down in the middle here. Thank you.
Paul Dare, and I received 100 free Abbey National shares on demutualisation in 1990 and now hold Santander shares. If there was one thing about corporate governance that you could change, what would that be?
UK corporate governance?
That'll do.
If it was to stop here, I think my answer is, if it would stop here and it would settle down at this point, I would be reasonably content. Apart from this, which I have a dread about the whole issue of this assessment, board assessment procedure, and whether or not this is going to get out of hand, and it could, it has the potential to create quite a lot of tension and quite a lot of difficulty. I think we have now got ourselves adjusted and adapted to this. I mentioned in my remarks, I think the role of the chairman in remuneration has been put into a very ambiguous and very difficult position because the chairman has obviously got a very important part to play in the remuneration of the chief executive. You know, you hire the person after all. You've also got to pay quite a lot of interest in the remuneration of the senior executives. You see them more than anybody else does. And yet, according to the corporate governance arrangements, you're not supposed to sit on the remuneration committee. What happens, of course, is that chairmen very often are there in attendance, but they're officially not a member. And then this produces all manner of problems, I find, in some places about who it is who is actually bringing forward the proposals and how you get a sensible approach to this. And I have, there will be some problems emerge on this front. Either the thing will not, people will say it's being operated one way and it will actually be operated a different way, or we're going to have to find, some other way through some of this. But it is quite time consuming, corporate governance. It's a bit of pressure. I think I also mentioned that, at times it can be time consuming. I think some of the issues about the tests of independence, I think some of the tests, including how long people have been on the board, are just beginning to stretch us a little bit in terms of meaning that you've got to lose people when you wouldn't want to lose them. But what I really fear is that this is not over. I mean, my biggest fear is that there will just be more and more attempts to widen representation in various ways on boards, and the whole assessment process will get us into a position where boards cease to function as effectively as they, as the successful ones do in terms of a unitary board.
I just add my own two pennies on that question, and you just alluded to it. But one which I was concerned about at the FSA, and still I am, is the increasingly aggressive term limits on directors, particularly in relation to banks. I mean, being on the board of a bank and running a bank, actually, in very easy economic circumstances, is normally a piece of cake. And the time you run into trouble is when people overextend at the top of the boom, and then in the recession they discover all the horrible things that they did. And the idea of having very tight term limits on non-executive directors in banks, I think, is potentially not a good idea. At the FSA, before Higgs, we used to rather like the idea that there were some non-execs who'd lived through the last recession and who in the good times would occasionally be the brakes saying, hang on, I can remember when we were thrilled at extending these loans and we paid the penalty subsequently. So my own view is that that's...
It's particularly the case, too, with audit committees. I have somebody who has been chairman of the audit committee for... for some time and who is extremely good at it. His term, you know, if it hadn't been that we've had the takeover, his term was coming to an end. He'd done his 9 years because he'd been on a predecessor board that had been taken over by Abbey. And to find people who can be chairman of audit committees of banks, I have to tell you, is extremely difficult. But it's become an obsession about, you know, this notion about time limits equaling independence, and I see no sign of it. You know, I mean, I don't see any correlation between this at all.
Well, and Dan.
Thank you. Manfred Scapers. You've just been, or Abbey National is now owned by a Spanish bank, and Howard mentioned that we've now got a single regulator, but yeah, most of the city's time is being spent with regulation that's coming out of Brussels and out of Europe. And a lot of the crises are being addressed now globally, i.e. the SEC and CSAR are hand in glove whenever there's a crisis. Mm. So a lot of the governance in the city is really not that, you know, it's mainly coming out of external factors than internal UK factors. So the question is, how do you see, you know, the city having to react to that, and should we just get used to the fact that the regulation is going to be coming out of non-UK sources and learn to live with it? Or is this something that the city should defend itself against?
Well, Howard knows more about this than me, but I would have said that most of, certainly in terms of the, with the exception of Sarbanes-Oxley, I would say that most of the regulation that and that I am subject to in various activities, you know, is very much homegrown. Now, part of this may be because we have been moving faster in some of these areas than other people, and there may begin to be a problem, you know, when others start to catch up with this. I mean, the arrangements we now have is that Abbey is going to be regulated as a subsidiary of Santander, which, you know, they didn't have to do it that way, but I think much to the FSA's relief, they have decided to do it that way, which means that we are still subject, you know, to for most purposes, to the same regime that we were subject to previously. And, you know, a lot of, you know, the retail financial sector, which is the one that I have been working in, you know, I mean, it's still pretty much, you know, it up till now, it hasn't travelled terribly well from country to country. I mean, a lot, you know, and things may be now about to change. So these may be issues for the future, but I'm not conscious of this being an issue now. I mean, there are some banks, and those who are, you know, the wholesale banks and the people who are involved in more of the international aspect of things who, you know, who I see do complaining about the fact that we're not taking a big enough lead in some of the European issues, but this is not an issue which affects my side of the business very much at all.
I can just offer one. There's a long answer to this, Manfred, and there's a short answer, and I'll give you the very short answer, which is that in almost every occasion when there's a European directive, what you find in the UK imposed on the city is not quite what you would have done if you'd been left to yourself. It's not quite right, and it's almost by definition not quite right if you've got to agree it with 15 or now with 25. And the question is, does the free trade dimension, the cross-border dimension advantage of having a common standard that you can use, outweigh the disadvantage of the fact that it's not quite really what you would have devised if you'd been left to your own devices? And I guess my very short answer to that is, in most of the wholesale areas, it probably does outweigh those domestic disadvantages. And that currently, in most of the retail areas, it doesn't. Because actually, the amount of cross-border retail traffic business is actually trivial. And even when you get a big takeover like Santander and Abbey, they actually leave it in the domestic regime, because that's what people know and that's what people are comfortable with. And so my own view is that the Commission's attempts to push European regulation extensively into retail areas would not pass a normal cost-benefit test, because it's the tail of a small amount of cross-border traffic wagging the dog of common regulation across, you know, a whole variety of different countries. But, you know, that's just a very general.
But it is the area where the pain is being felt when things go wrong.
Yeah, it is. It's uncomfortable. Take one more over here, and then I think Terry probably deserves a drink after that.
I believe you have a CSR committee which operates at board level. That's not something that's really been covered to any great extent by the combined code. So do you see that as being something that is integral to a modern governance structure? And if so, why?
I think this, you know, it varies from industry to industry. As one of my jobs is, is in the water industry, you know, and all of that, you know, the whole environmental issues, you know, are a completely integral part of what it is that we do. I think with the other businesses, most of what is covered by that are that whole area. Are issues and things that you would be wanting to address anyway. I mean, I am, you know, I get worried a bit that there's another area where there is, you sometimes are being forced to do things in a way that you wouldn't necessarily choose to do, but in order to get a certain amount of, you know, standardization across businesses. But it is, you know, in general, I'm quite happy with the way that we deal with it. I'm quite happy with the pressures on that, you know, as long as it is, as long as there isn't pressure for too much standardization. I mean, I think, you know, some people are being forced to jump through hurdles and to try to display things and present their information in a way which is rather, distorted. And it takes up a certain amount of senior people's time, but. You know, in well-run businesses, it is an integral part of what it is that you're doing anyway. You know, I mean, it is things that you're concerned about, and you know, it would be slightly surprising, and indeed, it would be slightly worrying. I think that if this was an issue that was really leading you by the nose and forcing you to do things that you wouldn't normally do. I mean, so far, I don't think that is the case. I mean, my slight worry is that it's raised to a level which is, you know, which does imply that it is something that is different rather than just being something which should be a natural part and parcel of your business.
Thank you. I think is it a quick one?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, you're standing between us and the drink, so...
All right. My name's Nick Jones. My concern is that we're moving down a path of corporate sclerosis where economic activity will be transferred to other domains, and that public companies will remove themselves from the public to the private sector. Indeed, executive talent will also remove themselves from the public domain. Is this a concern you share?
Well, I mean, some of it does move, but I mean, there are some quite important barriers in terms of size and just what it is that that you can do, I think, at this stage. I mean, it is slight, you know, the glare of public scrutiny through being involved in listed companies. I mean, at times it's slightly unpleasant. You know, you've got to go through the you know, people are obsessed about pay. And then you have the AGM process. I mean, those, you know, if I ask what are the two real inconveniences to my life of this this glare of publicity? I mean, they are the obsession about pay and the difficulty that, you know, and particularly when, you know, people are leaving, and the whole question about what the terms are. And the fact that you once a year got to go through and particularly if you're in a business where a lot of your shareholders are also customers, you know, you go through a rather painful process of having all of your failures and pointed out to you at AGMs. But I think this is, frankly, I think it's overstated. I think that most of the things that we are required to do under the codes. With a few exceptions, which we've touched already, I think they amount to things which are by and large sensible ways of conducting business, and I don't think that they get in the way hugely of a successful business. You get some. I mean, where there are the beginnings of, you know, there's another company I'm involved with which has got a very large U.S. presence, and you begin to get some quite. You know, you get some difficulties there about how you handle, again, pay, remuneration, and people's conditions when you've got people who are working in different domains. But you know, there are an awful lot of successful businesses who are, you know, who are subject to this regime and indeed working successfully internationally. And so far there has been a limit in the sense as to how far the private equity can, you know, can deal and the size of companies that they can deal with. And I think that's going to remain a bit of a block for some time to come. I think it's one of those fashionable things that is talked about at this stage, because we've been through a slightly difficult patch with a lot of with some companies, and we've been through quite a lot of change. But you know, if I was to list all of the reasons as to why, or think through the reasons as to why, you know, some companies are not doing as well as they might do in terms of international competition, I don't think this is it's a huge one. And particularly if you take financial institutions, as I mentioned, you know, the fact that London is as open as it is, and in terms of allowing anybody to come and do business here, we have very few controls. Well, I have none, you know, in terms of what nationalities people might be who come and be the senior executives. We have very few, no controls to speak of over takeovers, you know, in terms of political aspects of them. And the result is that we have got this extraordinary, thriving financial services community in London. I mean, it's not, you know, I'm not sure that I see the real challenge here.
I'm going to stop now because we've run slightly over time, which is a tribute to the interest that your remarks, Terry, have generated. We've covered a very broad field, from the role of the Treasury, financial regulation, corporate governance, etc. We're very grateful to you for coming and for putting obviously such a lot of effort into covering this waterfront for our benefit. We now move into the atrium, the Student Services Centre, which most of you will know, I think, just outside there and to the left, for a drink. And I know Terry will be particularly keen to talk to any Abbey National Endowment policy holders who have a red light on their letter. But ahead of that, let me thank you, Terry, on behalf of the City alumni of the school, for coming here this evening. Thank you.